For me as a minister, one of the things that I've always liked is about is historical things. And so I'm going to talk about something historical today. And so we're going to talk about a historical sermon in regard to a certain aspect of God's way of life today. And there will be a second one in a couple of weeks. So today I'm going to continue talking about the subject of godly governance. But we're going to talk about it in a more of a survey manner. And we're going to talk about godly governance in relation to the Old Testament. And so we're going to look at godly governments and how God established that in the Old Testament, how he dealt with the ancient nation of Israel. And we can learn certain things from that. And then in a couple of weeks, we'll be talking about godly governance from the New Testament perspective. So we'll look at godly governance in that situation. Now, you may say, well, what does this have to do with me or anything else? Well, whether you know it or not, godly governance has been a controversy in the Church of God. And we heard that godly government is from the top down. Does anybody remember that? Well, I do. Heard it many times. Well, as we look at what we're going to look at, what conclusion would you come to after we look at what we're going to examine? Is that what it tells you? Is there some godly form of governance that God set up, and that's the only form of governance that we as the church are to use? So we'll look at the Old Testament and see what it says. And what we want to do is understand it. It's not being critical. It's just we grow as Christians and we mature, and sometimes we get more insight into things as we go along. So what we do today in the church is not exactly what it was when I came in 1972. For example, we kept Pentecost on Monday when I came in, and that changed. Well, things do change with time. Not everything's going to change, but you have to be willing, okay, if this is what God is teaching and wants us to understand, then make the adjustment that is necessary in order to continue your relationship with God. So we're going to try to accomplish two things today. We're going to look at some principles that apply to all leadership, whether it's Old Testament, New Testament, whether it's in the church or out. There are certain principles of governance that always apply. So they apply to me, they apply to you, they apply to all of God's people and all of those in God's church. And secondly, as I said, we're going to look at the different forms of godly governance that you find in the church as the church in the wilderness and as the church moved on to the people of Israel living in their land and those kinds of things. They were the church at that particular time. So we're going to look at that and try to understand it more fully. So let's begin by looking at God's expectations as far as governance is concerned. As most of us know, the book of Deuteronomy was written at the end of Moses' life. The people of Israel had spent 40 years in the wilderness, and at the end of his life, Moses is saying, okay, I'm going to put some things together for you that you can take with you when you go into the land, and these will be good things for you to be aware of and live by. And so God inspired him to write the book of Deuteronomy. And when Moses was writing this, Moses was 120 years old, and he wrote down what we find in the book of Deuteronomy. And as you look at this, it's basically 300 years before Israel, and one of the things that it mentions is about a king. But it's 300 years before they actually request that. But God tells them, there's coming a day when you're going to ask for a king, and if you do, these are the qualities that I expect as far as a king is concerned. And this is mentioned in Deuteronomy in chapter 17. So God talks about a king in Israel. He said, eventually you're going to make this request, and these are the parameters that should guide in your choice of a king. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 14, it says, "When you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and possess it and dwell in it, and say, 'I will set a king over me like the nations that are around me,' you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses." So it's not who you choose, it's who I will choose. "One from among your brethren." So he was to be an Israelite. He was not to be a foreigner. He was to be an Israelite that God chose. "You will set a king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you," he says, "who is not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses to himself." So usually when you were multiplying horses, it was for the purpose of warfare. And he said, you're not to be a war-making nation. That's not the path that I want you to follow. That was the path that the Egyptians followed, and you don't want to follow their example. "For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again." I don't want you living like the Egyptians. If I wanted you to live like the Egyptians, you could have stayed in Egypt. He goes on in verse 17 to say, "Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away." And as you may have noted in the world today, you can very easily get off track and get yourself into serious trouble as you are indiscreet morally and you become involved in sexual sin. And sexual sin can very easily lead a leader astray and cause him all sorts of difficulties. So many times it has led to people in authority and their downfall. It says, "Nor shall he greatly multiply gold and silver to himself." So he's not to use his office to enrich himself. That never happens with people in governance, does it? They use their office to enrich themselves. So anyway, God says, don't do that, because then you're going to put enriching your bank account ahead of the service of the people of God, maybe even taking advantage of the people of God. Verse 18 says, "Also, it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one whom before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel." So as you look at this, what was to be the foundation of a king? And any person in governance, God expects the foundation for their rule to be the Bible. And he told whoever was going to be king, he was to make his own copy of the Bible. You couldn't go to the store. You couldn't order it. You had to write it out or have somebody write it out for you. So he was to have his own copy of the scriptures. And if he was to write it, it was going to take a while. I know we had a couple of people that went through the process of reading through. I think they copied the scriptures. It took a while. It's not something you do in a day or two. It takes you a while, but it's a good thing to go through, and you learn certain things from writing the scriptures down and having your own copy. So that's why God tells you, study the Bible. Become familiar with the Bible, and we don't copy our own version of the Bible, but we have our own, and we can study it, we can pray over it, we can become familiar with it. And that's what God wanted them to be, guided by the scriptures. So they were familiar with the scriptures. They understood the scriptures, and they all usually had the priesthood that would help them, and sometimes a prophet who would help them to discern what the scriptures were saying. So as you look at human beings, they need to have the Bible, which tends to bring most people in an exalted position like a king back to earth, to realize that you are subject to the God of heaven and you are answerable to him, and he has given you limits, and he's given you instructions as far as how you are to live. So they were to print out their own copy, write it all out word by word, and have that as part of their kingship. So when Israel came to want a king, so you want a king, and when the time came, during the time of Samuel, when they wanted a king, God warned them. So the last of the judges was Samuel, and Samuel was a good judge. However, he appointed his sons to be judges in Israel, and they were not anywhere near Samuel's caliber. So they were doing all sorts of sinful things and not living up to what a leader should be like. So the people said, okay, we've had your sons, we don't want them, and we want a king. So God said, okay. And the thing was that God noted, and Samuel was offended that they were asking for a king, because he took it as a criticism of his judgeship. Well, it was mainly a criticism of his sons, but God said, okay, it's okay. I will give them a king. And okay, that's fine. I'll give you a king, and I will appoint him, but it may not work out as well as you think it's going to. Because who was their first king? A man by the name of Saul. And how did Saul do as a king? Not so well. He was not a man after God's own heart like his successor, David. But he lived, he was a man, and he, if you looked at him, he looked like a king. He was taller than anybody else. He was strong. And when he was young, very impressive. But he was a carnal individual and did not yield to God. And so God basically dismissed him as king. And God was very pleased with David because David had a different heart. David was yielded to God and his spirit, and he was willing to be corrected. He wasn't perfect, but he was able to make corrections as God dealt with him. And the prophet confronted him about a particular issue that he needed to deal with. So with that in mind, let's go to look at the Old Testament and the different governmental structures that we find in the Old Testament. And what you find as you go through the Old Testament and do this survey, what you find is there are basically seven different periods that you find in Israel's history. So the first period that you come to and that you can examine is the time of the patriarchs. And basically it goes from Adam, it goes through Adam all the way down to when God established the nation of Israel. That would be the time of the patriarchs. And prior to that, to the time of God's calling Israel out of Egypt, God basically worked with individual households through the head of the household. That's what you find with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's what you find with Noah. You find this throughout the Old Testament prior to God calling Israel out. As you go back to Genesis 3 and you find this structure in place, what does Satan do in order to undermine the structure? Who does he attack? He attacks the structure, but he does not attack the person who's in charge of the structure. He goes to that second person, Eve, and he attacks her and seeks to undermine the structure. He goes directly after Eve, and he deceives her, and unfortunately, the head of the household goes along with what she is doing in eating of what God said don't eat, and we have the downfall of man and getting off track there right at the beginning. From the time of Adam to Moses is basically summarized in Genesis chapter 18, beginning in verse 17. So if you wanted to summarize that period, you can find it in Genesis chapter 18, beginning in verse 17. And there you had God and come out in the form of Jesus Christ. He's there in a form that Abraham could see. Abraham sees him and invites him to have a meal with him, and there are angels with him as well. And verse 18, chapter 18, verse 17 says, "And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they make that they keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he had spoken to him. And the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is grave, then I'm going to have to take action against them." And he let Abraham know what he was going to do. So these verses basically summarize the patriarchal system and the approach that God used in dealing with that system, working with the patriarchs. And he worked that way on up until the time that God called Israel out of Egypt. The next period is the time of the establishment of the nation of Israel. So it's the time of Moses when Israel was established as a nation. It's about 500 years after Abraham, and God delivered Abraham's descendants out of Egypt as he had promised. You know, in Abraham's time, God said, okay, you're going to be enslaved, you're going to go through all of these things, but eventually I'm going to intervene and I'm going to bring you out of Egypt, which he did. But it was about 500 years between when God told Abraham this and he invited and he called Israel and brought them out of Egypt. So God set out to make them a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, as he explains in Exodus chapter 19, verse 6. And so God lays this out, and he's going to work with them, and he expected them to be a kingdom of priests, to be an example nation to the world. But they didn't live up to that. They didn't live up to that, sadly. And but God gave them that opportunity and explained that that was their opportunity if they chose to take advantage of it. So God, as he brought them to Mount Sinai, gave the people of Israel the Ten Commandments. He gave them the statutes and the judgments by which they would be governed. Basically, he laid out their constitution. This is how you are to be governed, by these stipulations which I'm going to lay out for you, which if you will follow them, you will be blessed as a nation, because it will all work as it should. It will all work as it should. And but these people were physical, carnal people, and when God spoke directly to them, they did not like that. They said, hey, look, we don't want God speaking to us directly anymore. Moses, if God has something to say to us, please, you talk to God, and then you can relay it to all of us. They did not want God dealing directly with them. So God didn't. God worked through Moses, and God taught them, and God did what he had to do in order to govern over them. So then we come to another period, which is in Moses' time, and this period would be the third period, and it's the time in which God ruled Israel through rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. So God said, look, we can delegate authority, and yes, Moses, you're in charge overall, but if we delegate authority, you won't have to carry the whole burden, and these other people can help you in governing the nation of Israel. So in Exodus chapter 18, it spells out for us the delegation of authority. And it's interesting where this understanding came from. Moses didn't have that understanding. He didn't see it. He knew he was overwhelmed, and he's sitting there all day answering questions and dealing with controversies, and, well, my tent is here and their tent is on my side, and dealing with all of this petty stuff that you had to deal with. It had to be dealt with, you know, because people have controversies and conflicts. So Moses would sort it out. But he was overwhelmed, and Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, came for a visit, and he noticed, you know, you're spending all day doing this. That's all you're going to get done every day, and you're going to be worn out pretty fast. So let me give you some advice. And it's interesting, this man who's making this, giving them the advice, is a Midianite. In fact, he's a priest of Midian. Now, the priest of Midian was not a basically following God's way of life. He was a pagan priest, but he did have wisdom, and where you have wisdom, you have wisdom. So he told Moses, look, this is something that you need to do, and said, it's an option if you're willing to listen. And he said, you need to delegate authority. And that's where he talks about a system of people that you would appoint who would be captains of tens and captains of 50s and captains of 100 and captains of 1,000. So these people would have jurisdiction over these particular parts of the system. And as you look at the best, and you know, look at the world in which we live, the best government is local. When your government is in Washington, that's a long way from us living out here in Texas. And do they understand what we're going through, what we have to deal with? They don't. But if you have somebody that's in your community, then they actually know. And it works better when it's done locally. So that's what God was establishing here, is a system that, if it were rightly applied, would allow the needs of the people to be addressed. So if you live, you know, I live in Rosenberg. So if everything is basically the things that are going on in Rosenberg are dealt with in Rosenberg, then we're better off than having to deal with Austin or dealing with Washington. It just works better that way because they're living there with you. It's just the better way to work. So anyway, that's what God was setting up here. And he says that and Jethro offered this advice, and he basically did it. And as you go through and look at Exodus chapter 18, Jethro does acknowledge the God of Israel. Now, he may not have been a priest of the God of Israel, but he acknowledged that the God of Israel is greater than all the gods, which is quite an admission for a priest of Midian. Chapter 18, verse 12, it says, then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and other sacrifices to offer to God, and Aaron came with all the elders to Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. So they're laying these things out for Moses and the nation. Verse 13, and so it was on the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and this is where Jethro noticed how overwhelmed he was. And Jethro told him of the different way, the way of delegation. And he tells Moses, if you are to apply this system, how do you choose the men you're going to be that'll take on these responsibility? Chapter 18, verse 21 tells us. There it says, moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of 50s and rulers of 10s, and let them judge the people at all times. Then it will be that every great matter that they will bring to you, but every small matter they themselves shall judge. So it's just a system that would allow for delegation of authority and for the people's needs to be met, and it was an organized way to approach it all. So here's your father-in-law telling you this. Most of the time when your father-in-law tells you something, do we want to hear it? Most of the time not. It may be wise, but Moses had something going for him, which is explained in Numbers chapter 12, verse 3. And what does it note there? It says that Moses was very humble, more than all men who are on the face of the earth. He was humble. He was willing to listen. So he listened to his father-in-law, and he implemented what his father-in-law suggested. So this allowed Israel to establish a form of governance to take care of the needs of the people. And that's what governance is about. It's about those who are in positions of rulership, caring for the people, seeing their needs, doing what they can to meet those needs. So what he's explaining here is timeless. You want men of character, men or women of character. That's still the case. Who do we appoint in the church to serve in various offices? You look at people that the congregation recognize as displaying their diligent, they're faithful, they're willing to work, and we try to select them because the congregation recognizes them. They recognize them that they're already servants, and giving them an office, such as a deacon or an elder, is just a confirmation of what they've already been doing. So it's timeless, the qualities that Jethro explained. So they established this system, good system, nothing wrong with the system, but when you have humans involved, you can have breakdowns. So they had a breakdown in the system. So they had to go back to the drawing board, so God led them to look at how to deal with this. So as you see the story unfolding here, as we move on to the next part of the governance, and this is the fourth part, which is the establishment of elders, the establishment of elders in Israel. And this comes about because you had what are called, they're not Israelites, they were part of a mixed multitude. They were unhappy because they were not being able to eat meat, they were unhappy with that. The manna wasn't cutting it for them, so they bypassed the captains of 10s and 50s and all of that, and what did they do? They went directly to Moses, and they let their unhappiness be known. So the complaint and the demand for meat, they said, look, you know, this manna isn't cutting it. We need meat. So they confronted Moses, and Moses is like, oh, great. What do I do now? I'm out in the desert. We're out in the wilderness. How am I going to come up with meat? And he noted that, and he told God that. And God said, okay, here's what we're going to do. So Moses was frustrated, but God, okay, I've got this. Let me explain to you what we'll do to try to address the needs of the people of Israel. So there's a change made in the system, and it's recounted in Numbers chapter 11. Numbers chapter 11, beginning in verse 16. Numbers chapter 11, beginning in verse 16. There it says, so the Lord God said to Moses, gather me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be elders of the people, officers over them, bring them to the tabernacle of meeting, that they may stand there with you. So he said, gather me 70 men of the elders of Israel. So these were people that had status in the community, that were already carrying on offices in the community, and they were recognized for that. Verse 17, then I will come down and talk with you there. I will take the spirit that is upon you. See, Moses was led by God's spirit, so that was part of his life and allowed him to be able to administer the nation of Israel and serve the people. He had God's spirit, but the others did not. And so God says, you have God's spirit, and I'm going to help you in your job. And God said, I will take of the spirit that is upon you, that is my Holy Spirit, and put it upon them. And they shall bear the burden of the people with you, that you may not bear it yourself alone. So God said, look, I'm going to use these men, these 70 that you select, and I will pour out my spirit upon them. And they will be the ones that will help you in carrying out the governance of the people of Israel. So God established here elders in Israel, mature men who had years of experience behind them. They had spiritual maturity, and God added to him his Holy Spirit. And he gave these men his Spirit, and just as he had given it to Moses, and to give them the wisdom of God to handle the needs of the people of Israel. And that's how God began to rule in Israel, and it shouldn't be a surprise that we in the church are ruled and governed by elders. The premise, the standard, goes all the way back to Moses, and it's still an applicable system that works effectively as it's rightly applied. So here we see God establishing elders in Israel as part of the basic rulership structure of the land. And it was a good system. You know, if you have 70 people in the congregation who are led by God's Spirit, then you have the greatest potential to prosper and to be guided by wisdom. People who are going to make good decisions and are going to rightly serve the people. So Moses went through 40 years of serving the people of Israel, and his life came to an end as they were crossing over into the land of Canaan. And that brings us to Joshua chapter 1, verse 1. And we have another change that's going to take place here. Joshua chapter 1, verse 1. There it says, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving them, the children of Israel. Every place that your sole of your foot will tread, I have given you, as I said to Moses, from the wilderness and this Lebanon as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. That's a pretty extensive territory. If you look at Israel today, it's nowhere near that extensive. It's in a fairly confined area. But that's the way it was when Israel came into the land. So God said, I'm going to be with you. I'm not going to leave you nor forsake you. Joshua chapter 7, verse 1. Joshua chapter 7, verse 1. There it continues to talk about how God ruled during Joshua's time. And Joshua 7, verse 1 says, but the children of Israel committed a trespass regarding the accursed thing, for Achan the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took of the accursed things. So the anger of the Lord burned against the children of Israel. So we're familiar with this story. God said, do not take any of the loot, the booty that you get from conquering these places. This is mine. But Achan saw that, wow, look at all this gold and all the goodies that are here. Surely if I take some of it, it won't be a problem. And God said, no, you can't do that. Well, I just took a little bit. And God said, no, you can't do that, and suffered the consequences of not following God's instruction. And what happened was they were defeated at the town of Ai. They thought, we're going to blow these guys out. And sure enough, that the people of Ai defeated them, and they lost quite a number of men. So Joshua was frustrated by that because he didn't expect this defeat. Joshua chapter 7, verse 6. Then Joshua tore his clothes and fell to the earth on his face before the ark of the Lord until evening. And look who's involved here. He and the elders of Israel. And they put dust on their heads. So they recognized this was a significant issue that they needed to deal with. And to where did they turn? They turned to God. Both Joshua and the elders, they all went before God and asked for God's intervention and wisdom in order to handle the situation. Joshua chapter 8, verse 10. There it says, then Joshua rose up early in the morning and mustered the people and went up, he and the elders of Israel, before the people of Ai. So I'm just showing you that as Joshua took over from Moses, then Joshua was in charge, but He also had the elders working with him and serving with him to lead the people of Israel. So clearly it appears that the system of government established in Numbers 11 continued. It was a system that continued throughout Moses' rule and was in place during the time of Joshua as well. And it continued on beyond Joshua's death. Joshua's death. So it's interesting to note that after Joshua's death, God did not designate one ruler. God had worked through Moses, then he had worked through Joshua, but as the people came into the land, he didn't establish a single ruler. He didn't establish a replacement for Joshua. So he chose to rule in a different way. So it appears after the death of Joshua that God governed Israel by and through the elders for a period of time. So he continued to govern them in that way, and as that eventually worked out, we had come to the fifth period, which is the period of the judges. So the elders, God said, look, you know, if you think about it, who is the ruler? When you look at the system of the elders, Joshua's not there. Who is ultimately the ruler? It's God. God is their leader. And the elders are the ones who actually are on the ground, and God is working through them to govern Israel. So so anyway, you have the system of the judges that are established, and we see this discussed in Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 18. So Moses actually told the people of Israel about what was going to happen as they went forward. Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 18. There it says, "You shall appoint judges and officers in all your gates, which the Lord your God gives you according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with just judgment." So they're going to judge the people, and they're to do so in a just way. It says, "You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality, nor take a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. You shall follow what is altogether just, that you may live and inherit the land which the Lord your God is giving you." Imagine if we took what's said here seriously and judgment was done in this particular way. What a difference it would make. So God here addressed Israel's needs for a judicial system. And he said, you're to appoint capable judges who would judge properly. And this passage also points to officers, some sort of executive system of some kind. We don't know every detail, but there seems to have been some kind of executive system that carried on after Joshua's death. So the elders were put into place before Joshua's death, and they were to carry on and administer the governance of Israel as God stipulated. So we begin into the time of the judges. You go back to the time of Gideon in Judges chapter 8. Judges chapter 8. And there it talks about Gideon. Gideon was one of the judges that we find in the book of Judges. And just making note of a few things here with a couple of judges and how they ruled. Let's go to Judges chapter 8, verse 13. So it talks about Gideon coming back from a battle and coming down and ascent back into where he wanted to go. And it says in verse 14, "And he caught a young man of the men of Succoth and interrogated him. And he wrote down for him the leaders of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. So in Succoth you had elders, you had leaders of Succoth, who were these men that are pointed out here. So, and they wrote them down. Okay, I know who they are, and I'll write them down for you. And then you come to Judges 11, verse 1, a different judge in a different scenario. It says, now Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty man of valor, and he was the son of a harlot, and Gilead begot Jephthah. So Jephthah had no standing in the community because he was the son of a harlot. So he was somebody that people didn't look through. Your pedigree is not clean and pure like we want it to be, so we're not going to have anything to do with you. So things go badly for Israel, and eventually the people of Israel say, you know what, things are going badly, and Jephthah is known as a warrior and is defeating the enemy, so maybe we should give Jephthah another shot. And so they go out, they send the elders out to him and say, look, things aren't going so well, we would like you to be our commander, to be our deliverer. And Jephthah says, okay. He was willing to do it, but he also set some stipulations, which we won't go into. So he went, led them out to fight with the people of Ammon, and Jephthah was able to take on that role, and he was also assisted by the elders of the land. They also helped him. So during the time period after Joshua, Israel was governed by judges, by officers and elders for a period of about 300 years, and which takes us down to when takes us down to the time when they wanted a king. That's going to be the next stage we go into. So, as you think, as I mentioned, who is their ruler, and that is ultimately their judge and their king? Well, we learned that in Judges chapter 21, verse 25. Judges chapter 21, verse 25. And it tells us something important, and I would venture to say it is my opinion that this is quite a description, and it describes where we're at as a country. It says here, it says, Judges chapter 21, verse 25, in those days there was no king in Israel. Now, there was no king recognized, but was there a king in Israel? Absolutely. We know that king as God. God was their king. And it said, but what was everybody doing? Everyone did that which was right in his own eyes. I think we can see that going on. Everybody did that which was right in his own eyes. And what this verse points out is that no system of governance will work. No matter how good of a system it is, it's not going to work if people are not basically living by the right principles, applying those principles, both those who govern and those who are governed. So then we go on to the next stage, which is the period of the kings. The period of the kings. So as the time of the judges went on and came to an end, people said, look, your sons are corrupt, your sons are involved in all sorts of evil, and we don't want to have them ruling over us, so we want a king. And so that's when God says, okay, that's what they want, so we're going to have a king. It's okay with me, give them a king. And Samuel also describes to them, you know, he says, look, Samuel's offended and said, okay, look, you're going to have a king. And he said, well, you can have a king, but God said it's not going to work out like you think it is. You know, every year, and as Americans, we're very familiar with the fact that we have the chance to elect a new leader. And we all cheer and we're excited. Well, that new leader is going to straighten it out. It's not going to be straightened out. And sometimes it gets better, sometimes it gets worse, but it's not going to straighten it out like God would have it be. So we're just going to have to be along for the ride till the kingdom of God is established, and we can be ready to be a part of that kingdom and to take on the positions that God will give us as his kingdom is established. But it's not going to be fixed this side of the coming of God's kingdom. So anyway, basically God said, look, they've rejected me. They've not rejected you. Because I'm to be their king. but they don't acknowledge me. And they somehow are thinking that, you know, if we get a king in here, he's going to be the one that's going to straighten everything out. And so God said, look, you need to relay to them. They have this idea that a king's going to fix everything. And you know what? It's going to be a rude awakening for them that king that they think is going to be the everything and going to straighten everything out is not going to work out like they think it would. And it didn't. And as you look at how he's described in 1 Samuel chapter 8, it tells you, okay, you're going to have a king, and there are going to be all these problems with that king. And, you know, it's interesting as, you know, we living in America have this idea that King George III was a terrible king. And I happened to read a book about King George by Andrew Roberts, and he talked about King George. And King George was actually not a bad king. You know, he gets a bad rap because, you know, it's basically propaganda talking about how bad he was and how we needed to rise up in revolution against the English and throw off their rulership. But if you examine the problems, they really weren't problems. Some of them, there were actual problems, but some of them, they may be exaggerated a bit. As you go through and look at the Declaration of Independence and examine the point by point, yes, they had some gripes and complaints, but King George wasn't that bad. Now, we can fight about it, but I'm just saying that it surprised me because that's not the American perspective. And Americans would never indulge in propaganda. So anyway, so it kind of surprised me. You know, you have a certain idea because we want everybody to overthrow the British. Well, if we get everybody stirred up, that's how we can accomplish it. So, and God allowed it. God allowed that whole thing to play out. So as you look at the kings ruled in Israel and in Judah for 400 years, and it brings us up to the time when Judah falls, and we start a new period after Judah was taken into captivity by the Babylonians and they were brought back into the land. And something new begins as God works with Judah. As we know, the northern kingdom of Israel fell to the Assyrians in 721 BC, and the southern kingdom of Judah fell to the Babylonians in 586 BC, and King Nebuchadnezzar conquered the people of Judah, carried them away captive, and we know from the book of Daniel that Nebuchadnezzar was a tyrant. Now, God worked with him, and he changed his tune to a degree, but he was a tyrant when we first meet him. He's had a dream, and he expects his wise men to tell him the dream and what the dream means. And all the wise men say, there's no way we can do this. And there's no way we can fake it. He said, you guys tell me the dream and what it means. And they all knew, we can't do this. So they all knew we're done for because we can't do this. They couldn't fake it because Nebuchadnezzar knew what the dream was. So you couldn't make something up. So they were in trouble. And they were blessed to be able to have Daniel there, who realized the predicament that they were in. He went to God and appealed to God, and God said, okay, I'll give you the answer to this, and he did. And Daniel was able to tell Nebuchadnezzar the dream and its meaning. He's able to lay that out there because it wasn't that Daniel was so smart, it was that God was able to give him that information, and he was able to share it with the king. So, and Nebuchadnezzar was, as I said, he was a tyrant, and he basically said, if you guys don't do what I want you to do in the way that I want you to do it, then I'll kill you, your families, destroy your house, and there will be nothing left of you. But that was the way he approached things. And God had to take him down a peg or two, which we have a chronicle of that taking place. And after Nebuchadnezzar went crazy for a while, then he had a different, was singing a different tune. and recognize that there is a God in heaven that is much bigger than he is, much more powerful than he was, and he was willing to acknowledge that God to a degree. So God basically broke his pride. This basically caused that pride to be diminished, and he was able to be yielded to God to a certain extent, and God was merciful to him. So as you look at Nebuchadnezzar, he was a person who learned certain lessons, and God has put those lessons in the Bible for us. But God ruled the people of Israel, the people of Judah, through the Babylonians for a while. The Babylonians fell to the Persians, and the Persians ruled for a while. We know that Cyrus was their king, and through Cyrus, he opened the way for the people of Judah to return to the land and to be able to go to the land. And so they were able to go back. They went back to the land, and as they went back to the land, as we've looked at in the minor prophets, we've seen that it was difficult as they went back to the land. And so they had great difficulties. We know that during the time in which they were in Persia, that they sought to destroy the people of Judah during the time of Queen Esther. And God was merciful to them during that time. And then he allowed leaders to take the people of Israel back to the land and lead them. And so they were able to go back to the land of promise to rebuild the temple, to reestablish the true worship. And God worked through Ezra and Nehemiah and others at that time. And God carried them all the way through to the time when come down to the time of Christ. And at that point in time, God said, all right, I'm going to take a totally new tact. We're going to change course here completely. So I've worked through a people, the people of Israel up to this point, the physical people of Israel, but that's not how we're going to work going forward. So what does God do? God establishes the church. God establishes the church, and he pours out his spirit upon the people in God's church, and a new system comes online, and we will look at that next week. So we'll examine how God rules the church through his spirit. He's still working through his spirit. It was the same spirit that was him leading the people, Moses and Joshua and the elders. Same spirit, hasn't changed. It's just that God's spirit is leading us in a little different way in order that we can govern ourselves and be pleasing to God, and most importantly, that God would work in us and prepare us for the coming of his kingdom. So thank you for your attention. So we'll stop there. I know you're amazed it's only 3 o'clock.